This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week, there's so much legal news that I'm excited to say we are joined by Greg Storr, who has been the Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter since 1998. He covers all the major Supreme Court cases in addition to important lower court decisions as well. We're talking with him about the Trump administration's recent attempt to use the Alien Enemies Act in order to deport people who are in this country. We're also going to talk to him more broadly about whether or not we are in a constitutional crisis. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. Please, as always, rate, review, and subscribe. Greg, thank you so much for being here. And I want to jump right back in and talk about the biggest legal news so far of the day, which is the Trump administration's attempt to use the Alien Enemies Act, a 1798 law, in order to deport people who are here from Venezuela. There's been a lot of court wrangling. There is going to be yet another hearing in about 53 minutes. And I just would love to start with a very brief background on this late 18th century statute. What can you tell us about the Alien Enemies Act and when it's been used in the past?
Sure, and thanks for having me, Jessica. Well, this law is part of what had been collectively known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. This is the only part of it that's still in operation. And it's been used, as I understand it, only three times in the country's history, all in declared wars, the War of 1812, World War II, and World War One. And what the law says is that the president can basically bypass the usual immigration laws to deport people when the U.S. is involved in either a declared war or when a foreign nation has started or attempted or threatened an invasion or a predatory incursion. And Trump is trying to use that law in a very different context now.
So my understanding is that the Trump administration's argument is hinging on the clause after the word or, the invasion or predatory incursion. And as you said, in the statute, basically says the president can issue a public proclamation and find that there is an invasion or predatory incursion. And that's the moment where the triggering facts are satisfied and the president can use the Alien Enemies Act. And just to emphasize, has anybody ever tried to use this provision, this part of the statute?
No. It has only been when there is a declared war, this notion of an invasion, even though, there was an invasion during the War of 1812. My understanding is that the provision was, it was the declared war part of it that was invoked.
Yes, as you said, War of 1812, World War One, World War II, and of course, we use the Alien Enemies Act in order to try and support the idea of having internment camps during World War II. So as I understand it, this is a somewhat new legal theory of using this very old law, but it's still a law that's on the books. What are some steps that the Trump administration has taken other than to say, we can use it? It seems to me that they've been laying the groundwork in a variety of different ways to say, oh, we're here. We're at the moment where we can tap into the power that the statute provides us.
Yeah. So in this proclamation that the president issued, he actually signed it on Friday night, but then made it public on Saturday. He says that this Venezuelan gang known as Tren de Aragua has already been designated as a terrorist organization, and that what they are doing here in the United States constitutes an invasion. And it goes on to talk about how they've essentially become a foreign state on their own. He is using those declarations as the legal basis for the deportation steps that the administration has taken.
Right. And I noticed that a number of the executive orders have used words like invasion. Obviously, as you said, there was a designation of this gang as a foreign terrorist organization, all seeming to lay the framework for using this particular statute. Now, as you said, that there was a proclamation that was actually written on Friday night and publicly released on Saturday. There was an immediate hearing over the weekend in a federal courthouse. Can you tell us what the judge said and why the judge granted a temporary restraining order saying, Alien Enemies Act, I'm not seeing it right now, essentially?
Yeah, so the judge did several things over the course of this hearing that lasted at least a couple hours. The judge first, so the proclamation was challenged by five individuals represented by the ACLU and Democracy Forward. And the first thing the judge did was to issue a temporary restraining order blocking the deportation of those five people. And that actually is still in force, and those five people, as we speak, at least as far as we know, are still in the United States. But then it became clear over the course of the hearing that there were other people who were being deported, and that there were planes that were prepared to take them out of the country very, very quickly. And the judge in the hearing first made a verbal order in which he said, you need to stop those planes. If they haven't taken off, don't let them take off. If they're in the air, they need to turn back. Later on, the judge issued a written order, what's known as a minute order, that is typically sort of formalizes what a judge said in court. That order said that the administration couldn't take steps to deport these people. There was a class that was provisionally certified, but it didn't have the specificity of saying if there are planes in the air, they need to turn around.
So there was a difference between the initial verbal order and the written order, and it did involve the planes that were mid-air and whether or not those planes were covered by the order. My understanding is that, generally speaking, a judge's verbal order carries the force of law, but that when it comes to temporary restraining orders, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 65, I believe, indicates that maybe temporary restraining orders barring an emergency do need to be reduced to a writing. Could you help us understand this argument about what actually needs to be reduced to a writing and whether or not that had any legal effect in this case?
Yeah, so I think we are all still figuring this out on the fly because the government just made a couple of remarkable filings within the last hour or so. The way at least I've said it in my initial story is that they are arguing that the written order superseded the oral order. The written order did not say anything about the planes turning back. And so that is what they are arguing governs. I confess I have not gotten into the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, so you may know more about this than I do at this stage, Jessica.
Well, sadly, I have taken a bit of a dive into the federal rules. And what I will say is I think that they envision that temporary restraining orders should be reduced to a writing, in part just for clarity's sake. But there does seem to be some wiggle room for emergency circumstances. And I think this would qualify as one. So this is one of those stay tuned. But I will say that your coverage, as always, has been very nuanced. And some of what I see, particularly on social media, is just this kind of sledgehammer approach on either side. So I do think it's important for us to kind of think through the specifics of what's being argued in court as opposed to what's being said outside of court. Now, so one of the arguments from the Trump administration seems to be, well, the written order supersedes the verbal order. Could you help us think through some of the other arguments here? I know one of the arguments centers on jurisdiction and mid-air flights. Another argument seems to center on the idea that these are decisions only for a president to make. Can you give us more details and what am I missing here?
Yeah. So first, if I could, I want to read just a little bit of what Judge Boasberg said in his verbal order, just because of how clear it was. There's really no question about what he was saying in court. The judge said, any plane containing these folks that is going to take off or is in the air needs to be returned to the United States. He went on, but that will give you a little bit of a flavor of it. In terms of what the Trump administration is arguing, so one thing they argue is that under the Alien Enemies Act, once somebody leaves U.S. territory, U.S. airspace, that person has been removed. And because of that, once that happens, a federal judge no longer has jurisdiction over the case. So if Judge Boasberg did have jurisdiction while the folks were still on the ground here in the U.S., that jurisdiction disappeared once the plane entered U.S. airspace. That's the argument. And then the second argument that the president's making, and this is probably the most far-reaching thing he's saying, is I don't even need the Alien Enemies Act. My inherent authority as commander-in-chief gives me the authority to do that. So even if everything the ACLU is saying about the 1798 law is correct, I still have the ability to deport these folks because for national security reasons, because they're so dangerous.
And that is, in my view, and I think you characterized it this way, that is a very broad argument that would, in my opinion, upend our understanding of executive authority. Certainly, there are inherent powers, but we see a consistent strategy by the Trump administration of trying to enlarge those powers in a way that I would offer we haven't seen in the past. Now, Greg, what happens next in this case? The episode will probably come out about 15 hours after we're having this conversation. So obviously, some things will change. There is a hearing, as I said, in now about 40 minutes. But what are the next steps here? I know while we've been recording, there has now been an effort by the government to remove Judge Boasberg from the case, saying that his actions are, quote, an inappropriate exercise of jurisdiction. What do we need to be aware of in terms of next steps?
Yeah, really a remarkable set of filings from the Justice Department within the last hour. They asked the judge to cancel the hearing. And one of the things the Justice Department is saying in one of these filings when calling on the judge to cancel the hearing is that the government, quote, is not prepared to disclose any further national security or operational security details to plaintiffs or the public. The hearing was designed for the judge wanted the government to provide answers to basically, you know, what did you know? When did you know it? When did these flights take off? That sort of thing. And the government says, we're not going to give you any more information than we've given you here in writing when they said that we didn't violate the order. And Judge Boasberg very quickly denied that request to cancel the hearing. I suppose it's possible the government will not show up. We will see. That would certainly ratchet this up a few other notches. I very much expect a highly contentious hearing, and I just can't predict where it's going to go.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see on that. As I said, obviously, the Trump administration's attempt to use the Alien Enemies Act, I think the biggest legal news so far of the week, but it's only Monday. And Greg, you are one of the nation's most preeminent Supreme Court reporters. So I don't want to leave this conversation without having a little bit of a conversation about the Supreme Court. And specifically, maybe we can start with, I know there are a number of cases where I'm asked about this, you're following them, where the last question is usually, will this end up with the Supreme Court and what's going to happen? What are some of the biggest legal questions since January 20th that you think might hit the court? And then maybe we can talk about Hampton-Dellinger and USAID and birthright citizenship really briefly, because we know those have either hit the court in some way or will.
Well, of course, one is the subject we've just been talking about, immigration, the meaning of the Alien Enemies Act, whether the president can invoke it to deport people, whether he has some sort of inherent national security power that overrides immigration laws. You mentioned birthright citizenship. There's an emergency application that's at the court now, actually three emergency applications, but they're essentially identical. And those don't directly get at the underlying question. They deal with an important procedural issue involving nationwide injunctions. But that question about whether the long understanding that the Constitution provides citizenship to virtually anybody born here, whether that's going to continue or whether the court's going to essentially overturn that long-held understanding, that's a big one. You have questions about the president's authority to impound appropriated funds that Congress has appropriated. The president has, of course, and Elon Musk and Doge have taken some rather dramatic steps to try to slash spending in a variety of ways. And some of those bump up against this notion that Congress is the branch of government that under the Constitution has the power of the purse. And so I suspect what we will see, whether the court will give the president broad power to say no, despite that appropriation, I'm not going to spend money in this particular area. And then finally, or at least the final one that's in my mind right now, is questions about the president's ability to control the executive branch, and specifically to fire people who run what we have been long thought of as independent agencies, agencies like the Federal Trade Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, where those folks, the leaders of those bodies, can't just be fired by the president. And in fact, they tend to have memberships that include members of the party opposite the president. So those are all issues that I'm pretty confident will get to the court in one form or another. And there are probably a whole bunch of others that I'm not thinking about.
No, that's really helpful. And I know that one of the cases, and you've touched on this, is the USAID case. And you just mentioned firings and funding freezes. And we know that USAID is an agency that in part provides foreign aid. I'm being extremely general in my description, and that much of the funding for that aid was cut, and that there was a question that went to the court. And I think there might have been some misunderstanding about actually how narrow the question that went to the court was and what the court said. So could you walk us through the specifics of what exactly was the court looking at in that USAID case? Because it wasn't the power of Doge, or it wasn't, was Elon Musk properly appointed? It really had to do with, in my understanding, contracts and grants that had already been completed. Am I right? What am I missing? What else should we know?
Yeah, that is the case, at least the part that got to the Supreme Court. The underlying lawsuit is bigger than that, not just about contracts and grants that have already been completed, but a federal judge issued an order. First, the judge issued an order that said, hey, I see you have this broad freeze on foreign aid payments, and I want to put that on hold. And then the groups that were suing came back and said, Judge, the government's not abiding by your earlier order. Can you do something more specific? And so what the judge did, and this is what got to the Supreme Court, was to say, okay, for work that was completed before the date of my original temporary restraining order, the government needs to pay the money that is due by end of the day tomorrow, which is, they got about 36 hours. And so what came up to the Supreme Court was the administration saying that the judge overreached with that particular order there.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that was sort of circulating about had to do with things like, did the Federal Appeals Court and the Supreme Court have jurisdiction to even consider the matter at this very early stage in the lawsuit, because normally a temporary restraining order can't be appealed. And what the Supreme Court did was it denied the request it had sort of a complicated and still to be worked out effect in that that deadline that the judge set had already expired. And so they essentially kicked the case back to him and said, judge, clarify what the government's exact obligations are going forward, given that the original deadline has passed. And that's still being worked out right now in terms of exactly what the government has to do.
And just to emphasize, the vote split in that particular order was?
It was 5-4. The Chief Justice and Justice Barrett joined the court's three liberals, and the four of Alito, Thomas, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch dissented.
And I tend to bristle at this question, so now I'll ask it to you. Do we think that there might be circumstances where this becomes a voting block in the sense that it seems to me that Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett are somewhere around what the middle of the court is, and we could have very lengthy conversation about what it means to be in the middle of any court. And of course, it's just comparative. But in looking back at the last term and decisions like EMTALA, the Idaho case that broadly dealt with the conflict between a state law and a federal law and abortions in limited life-saving circumstances, and some of her questioning, maybe, do we think that Justice Barrett might present and Chief Justice John Roberts, to a certain extent, a swing vote on some of these questions of the power of the federal government?
Yeah, I would bristle at the term swing justice because,
fair.
It sort of conveys, I think some of us used to like to call Sandra Day O'Connor a swing justice. And she was a very different kind of justice who would legitimately, if we're thinking in the world of liberal versus conservative, come out with some liberal results that push the law to the left. And that is not how I think of either the Chief Justice or Justice Barrett. The question is whether they're going to push the law to the right and how quickly they're going to do that. I mean, I think it is fair to say that Justice Barrett has shown herself to be a lot less willing to vote in favor of emergency intervention than some of her conservative colleagues. So I think it's at this point a pretty consistent pattern, and the Chief Justice is often with her in this, that when anybody comes up here, including this administration, and says, Supreme Court, you need to vacate that lower court order, stay that lower court order, do something that kind of change the state of play, she wants to be careful.
She seems more concerned about people running to the court for emergency intervention, as you said, and maybe at the very least has a preference for letting things fully play out in the lower courts, or at least that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely the case. And then she's often the other person that she's often coupled with in this is the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who famously cares a lot about the court's institutional standing. And I think it's fair to say that he is especially concerned with the perception that the court might be seen as intervening to help this administration or intervening to help any particular litigant or cause. And so he too can at times be somewhat cautious and a lot more cautious than justices like Thomas and Alito and Gorsuch.
Thank you for entertaining the question, which I know is a difficult one, not because you're not capable of tackling it, just because it requires us to look into the future to a certain extent. I want to end with the question about birthright citizenship, which is there is a birthright citizenship question generally before the Supreme Court right now, but I think many people, perhaps to the extent that they know about it, have just read a headline. Could you tell us exactly what is being asked of the Supreme Court at this moment? I know it's the Trump administration trying to pause lower court temporary restraining orders, but What are the specifics here that we might be missing?
Yeah, so there are three lawsuits that are at issue, and it's a combination of individuals, groups that immigrant rights groups that represent individuals, and some Democratic-led states who are involved in these lawsuits. And in all three cases, the district judge issued an order pausing the Trump administration's birthright citizenship restrictions, and an appeals court refused to intervene. So the Trump administration came to the Supreme Court. And it's not arguing at this stage, this is probably the most important thing, it's not arguing that the lower courts were wrong on the merits of the birthright citizenship question. It is arguing instead this procedural question that just keeps coming up over and over. And it's not necessarily a partisan thing, but certainly at this moment, it's the Republican Party that is upset by this. This notion of nationwide injunctions, the notion that a single trial judge can block a policy across the country. And so what they're asking the Supreme Court to do is to narrow all these temporary restraining orders so that they apply to perhaps just the individuals in the lawsuits, or maybe the and the individuals represented by these groups, or maybe just so that they apply in the states that sued. So if the Supreme Court were to grant that request, and if you'd like, I can tell you why it sort of looks like the Supreme Court's not going to, but if the court were to grant that request, what it would mean would be the administration's birthright citizenship restrictions could go into effect in much of the country, but not with regard to these particular litigants.
Well, I'm not going to refuse that offer. So yes, can you tell us a little bit about why you think they might not grant?
So this is really wonky, but I think it's important. What happens when somebody files an emergency request is normally the justice who's in charge of that asks for a response from the other side and sets a deadline for it. Well, in this case, there were three different justices who set the deadlines, but they set it 3 weeks into the future. So in an emergency request, that is like a lifetime. I can't think of, I may be forgetting something, but I can't think of a time when I have seen a justice give so much time for a response. And it just says to me that the court is really not interested, as much as they've expressed concerns about nationwide injunctions, that they are certainly in no hurry and perhaps have no interest at all in using this case about birthright citizenship to make a point about nationwide injunctions. That's my read of it. I just think the scheduling order is not a good sign for the Trump administration.
I totally agree. And yes, it's wonky, but it's also important. And that's how we read. I don't think this is just a few tea leaves. I think this is just a whole chunk of loose leaf tea. And I do think it's giving us an indication of where the court might go. Greg, we talked about a lot of things. We covered a lot of ground, Alien Enemies Act, what to look for in the Supreme Court. Generally, USAID, birthright citizenship. I wish we could have spent a few hours on each of those, but I know your time is so limited. So thank you so much for coming back to Passing Judgment and having this conversation with me.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it, Jessica.